Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about legal intersections between race, sex, and class. And later in the show, we will check in with California efforts to legalize marijuana on November 8th. But before we can move on, in what has become one of the clearest examples of the self-defeating nature of racism and sexism, a sick man on a plane was delayed getting medical attention because a ridiculous and most likely racist flight attendant refused to believe a black woman just behind him was a doctor. Dr. Tamika Cross, who is a resident physician in Houston, was in her seat when a man 2 rows in front of her became unresponsive and his wife screamed for help. Dr. Cross, remembering the oath of a physician, first, do no harm, jumped up and tried to help. A flight attendant, so not a doctor, then decides to wave her off because she knows exactly what's wrong and it's not a big deal. She claimed the guy was just having a bad nightmare. Of course, it is a big deal, and when that becomes clear and he continues to show panic and distress, the now non-doctor flight attendant finds she needs a doctor. She then pages for a doctor for anyone to come forward, and Dr. Cross hits her button to show she is, in fact, a doctor prepared to help. The flight attendant then says, get this, quote, oh, no, sweetie, put your hand down. We are looking for actual physicians or nurses or some type of medical personnel. We don't have time to talk to you. So I did not think she was a doctor. She didn't think she could be a nurse or a medical technician. Wow. Anyway, Dr. Cross tries to explain that she was, in fact, a doctor, and the airline staff continually treat her as if she was not one with condescending remarks. Finally, the flight attendant decides to maybe entertain the idea that a black woman could be a doctor and ask her to show her, quote, credentials and answer a number of random questions. And by the way, this is all happening when the guy who actually needs medical attention is still in distress and getting none. Then, even more shockingly, an older white male doctor approaches and the flight attendant says to Dr. Cross, well, you can sit down because this guy can help. She says, quote, he has his credentials. The thing is, the guy had not actually shown any credentials. This racist Delta flight attendant just assumed he looked more like a doctor. And insanely, 10 minutes after this, the flight attendant comes back to Dr. Cross to ask her, even though she spent the whole flight saying she wasn't a doctor, for her advice on how to handle this medical emergency. And since she is a real doctor, she does in fact help the man and his wife during the flight. The flight attendant recognizes that she got caught letting her racism out in public and repeatedly tries to apologize to Dr. Cross and offer her Sky Miles, yep, frequent flyer miles, to make up for it. Dr. Cross refused, took to Facebook and told the world, and turned this into a massive viral story. Delta has now sent a top executive to meet with Dr. Cross, and as she said in her Facebook post, whether this was race, age, gender discrimination, it's not right. She will not get away with this, and I will still get my Sky Miles. Republicans have been making a big issue out of alleged criminality by Hillary Clinton. At Donald Trump rallies, the cacophonous chants of lock her up are heard at numerous intervals as their fearless leader runs down a list of supposedly dastardly deeds done by Hillary and the whole Clinton clan. It's a storyline right out of WWE, but here it is in real life. And there are two sides to this. One is the liberal media making much too big a deal out of his threat to jail an opponent. American presidents have routinely jailed political opponents, of a lesser degree perhaps, but still, they did it. Abraham Lincoln even suspended the writ of habeas corpus, violating the Constitution, to jail some of his. The hue and cry about the quote-unquote threat to democracy is absurd because to some degree, as the Republican response shows, America isn't much of a democracy anyway. So let's listen to Mike Pence's defense of Trump's call for a special prosecutor to investigate Clinton, given her actions over the years.
It calls for the principle that no one is above the law.
The irony here is that so many people are above the law, most notably big banks. Can anyone forget the infamous too big to fail, which meant the Justice Department felt that they were too big to jail and thus refused to take significant legal action? Something we are again reminded of seeing that Wells Fargo's rampant corporate fraud didn't elicit anything more than a fine and some firings. Then there are the literally thousands of cops killing people, many unjustly, who then face zero accountability. As the Justice Department report into the San Francisco Police Department noted about that department, they weren't even doing real investigations when the police were killing people. We saw that as well in the city of Baltimore, where Marilyn Mosby revealed that the police had deliberately sabotaged her case trying to prosecute the killers of Freddie Gray. There was also India Kager in Virginia Beach, where no charges were leveled in an outrageous murder, where it turned out that several of the top law enforcement officials, including both the attorney general and the chief of police involved, were actually related. And of course, there's Eric Garner, choked out on tape by a cop who violated actual NYPD policy in terms of the chokehold method he used to kill Mr. Garner, and he just walked free. Clearly, many people are above the law in the United States, and the key determinant whether you face justice for your crime seems to be how much you're worth or whether or not you wear a badge. Anyone paying close attention to the news during the two conventions would have noted a few articles quoting lobbyists and donors saying that everything was business as usual, despite the election seeming like it may portend bad news from corporate America. The media narrative then was that Trump represented a major outsider challenge to corporate interests, and Hillary was adopting so many of Bernie Sanders' ideas she might even be a socialist. Time, of course, has shown most of this to be ridiculous, as Trump has proposed a huge tax relief for the ultra-wealthy, and Clinton has raised so much money from billionaires and corporate types that she is essentially already indebted to them for the next 4 years. As one Republican lobbyist said at the RNC, still business as usual. And one more confirmation of that, Paul Ryan is doing some bragging about his new fundraising totals and the nearly $50 million he's raised so far for congressional Republicans. That's a lot of cash. Where is it coming from? Well, you could probably guess, from rich people in corporate America. Ryan's personal fundraising, which he then transfers to other candidates through the National Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, is an impressive roster. His political action committee, Prosperity Action, has these top five donors: Elliott Management, a massive hedge fund; Woodbridge Investments, a big-time real estate developer in Texas; BGR Group, a lobbying firm which lobbies for many foreign governments; and Chevron; Koch Industries, say no more; and the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, which is a foundation run by big-time Wall Street guy Pete Peterson, who is on a one-man crusade to cut Social Security and Medicare benefits. When you look at Ryan's personal fundraising for his congressional campaign, which he also uses as a pass-through for other candidates, here are the top five. Blackstone Group, the world's largest investment firm; Pfizer, the pharmaceutical giant that had $7 billion in pure profits last year; Blue Cross Blue Shield, the insurance giant; and here it is again, Elliott Management, that big hedge fund; and rounding out the top five, Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's massive conglomerate. So yeah, in terms of who's going to owe who in Congress next year, it absolutely is business as usual. And those are today's talking points. And you were listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very excited to be able to continue this conversation with Anoa Chango, who's an attorney and host of The Way with Anoa, and also by Jessica Pielko, who is the vice president of law and the courts with our good friends at Rewired.News. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Of course, of course. So, Jessica, I'll start with you. Earlier this week, we covered the Ruth Bader Ginsburg comments about Colin Kaepernick, 49ers quarterback, and I think she said something around the lines, I'm pulling it up here, I think it's really dumb of them. Would I arrest them for doing it? No, I think it's dumb and disrespectful, end quote. And you responded to that with a comment in an article titled, Ruth Bader Ginsburg Shows Why White Feminists Must Do Better, saying that far too often race isn't centered in our political and cultural analysis, even if we believe it to be. So I was hoping you could just tell us a little bit more about the argument you were trying to unfold there. In that article, in the critique of the justice's comments.
Sure. Thank you so much. So, I think Justice Ginsburg's statements reflect something that is really important for progressive spaces, particular to tackle, and particularly white progressives, which was the point of my piece. Ginsburg is obviously a brilliant legal scholar and has stood on the right side of many issues, but her comments about the nature of the protests at hand show, in my opinion, a tone deafness on race. And when she suggests that, you know, well, I wouldn't arrest him for it, or that's not criminal. And so, you know, effectively suggesting that those are still constitutionally First Amendment protected activities. Those are true things, but they're diminished. And I think that my hope was with the piece was to create an opening for us to talk about the ways in which those personal bias and sort of the ways in which we regulate speech really do need to have a critical framing around them with regards to the way that structural inequality impacts who gets to speak, when they get to speak, and how they get to speak.
Mm-hmm. And Anoa, you know, I wonder the same. I mean, certainly as a black woman, I know you have to deal with this in general, but I know recently on social media, especially around a lot of the conversations about whether it's privileged or not privileged to vote for Hillary Clinton or not vote for Hillary Clinton, some of this has been popping up in terms of, you know, some more prominent white feminists raising a lot of these issues. I know you've been pushing back on this a little bit. So I wonder, you know, both in the context of Justice Ginsburg, but more general, how this conversation is sort of playing out for you on the day-to-day?
Just want to say, first off, love the Ginsburg piece and thought it gave a very good perspective. You know, it's a great legal mind that wrote it, obviously, but like the point that was just being made about progressive spaces, particularly being black and or woman in progressive spaces, right? It's a very, and we've seen this a lot over this past year with the rise of the Bernie Sanders movement and stuff. It's a very unique position to be in. Sometimes it's a very isolating position to be in, particularly when you do see overwhelming black support for, you know, during the primary, at least his major opponent, Secretary Clinton. And now, even now, to still not be a part of that inside group pushing for her election, to still kind of stay on the outside, it is a rather difficult place to be. But this notion that we've seen it happen a lot, that people who don't automatically support Secretary Clinton are either, it's whitewashed, right? So you automatically assume that anyone that does not support her is either male and or white, right? Or they're somehow privileged or fluent. And I think that there was a really good piece that was in put out by the Black Youth Project maybe 2 days ago that as a black person not voting for a major party could be interpreted also is not an issue of privilege, but it's taking a stand on so many of these issues that are not being addressed. Sure, you know, Secretary Clinton has given, you know, great, you know, speeches and has great one-liners about issues involving systemic racism and criminal justice reform. However, when you really start parsing away, not just with her rhetoric, but with some of the stuff from the Democratic Party as a whole, it's extremely problematic. We have a very difficult, intense relationship with the party. And when you really start looking at those criticisms, to have someone like Ms. Silverman most recently, not Sarah Silverman, the other Silverman sister, to say that, you know, if no one is voting for her, then they're privileged. You know, as a young black mother, I'm not privileged per se. And I guess having my own opinions about stuff makes me maybe more privileged. I don't know. It's a very difficult conversation, and there's so much more nuance there than what we've seen, you know, passed around in the badgering of voters who don't just fall in line. And with 25 days left, trying to get progressives on board, it's not going to work this way. It hasn't worked yet, so it the dialogue needs to change.
No, well, I hear you. And it's the nuance, I guess, it's one of those things where, like, everything is so nuanced, but for some reason we want to distill it down only to its most base essence. But, you know, Jessica, I think sort of the flip side of this in some way, I don't know if it's the flip side, but sort of related piece, and you pointed this out, I know, in an article about Utah v. Streiff, it was interesting to see that, which, for people who don't know, we did cover it on the show, but basically giving the police an unbelievable ability to just stop people. I mean, anyway. Terrible case. Basically, what it boils down to for our listeners, I should try to tell them, is if you get stopped illegally and then they end up finding some other thing on you, basically, than the original illegal search, it doesn't really matter, more or less. But anyway, long story short, Jessica, I thought it was interesting to note that, you know, the male justices all sided with the cops in this case, and all the woman justices dissented. And then Sonia Sotomayor was sort of a, I think, to some degree now famous dissent, although she was the only one to raise this, also adding in race. So it's like, to some degree, I think, especially probably for women in the legal profession, it's probably, you know, easy to sort of see a little bit better issues of implicit bias, bias in general, discrimination, because you experience it in some way in your own life. But then here's Sonia Sotomayor in this very unique position as a woman of color in a heavily male-dominated profession, and that coming through as well. So, I mean, I'm just curious, you know, maybe some of your thoughts and comments on all that.
I think it's absolutely on the money. I mean, and points to the reason why we need, you know, not just more women, but more women of color on the federal benches, because experience matters. And I think the contrast between Justice Sotomayor and in terms of her dissent in Streiff and Justice Ginsburg's, you know, off-the-cuff comments about Kaepernick's protest, I think really highlight that gulf in between, because I don't think anybody would suggest that neither of those women are liberal justices, for example. I mean, they are, you know, some of the most liberal justices that we have on the court. And, you know, the point that I want, that I raised in my piece with that is, you know, in Streiff, Justice Ginsburg joined largely with Justice Sotomayor's dissent, except for the portion that discussed race. And there's who knows the reasons why she did or did not do that. But it's important to point that out. And I mean, you know, it would be just as important to say that she doesn't get points just for signing on, for saying, hey, this is me exercising symbolic allyship. I mean, I think that those aren't zero sum things, right? People, particularly white progressive women, need to be doing better and need to be doing both. We need to show up and say, I'm signing on to the fourth portion of your dissent because it matters to me too, and then more. And I think, unfortunately or fortunately, what Justice Ginsburg's comments provide is an opportunity, particularly within my community as a white progressive woman, to push my people and say, listen, you know, we are not doing enough, and here is an excellent example of falling on our faces.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a good question. And it raises one other issue, too, and Noah, that I wanted to pop in there. It's, you know, seeing this thing with the black doctor and the flight attendant on the Delta flight. I mean, I wonder, you know, as a lawyer, I mean, is it a similar sort of feel there where there's almost like a credibility gap around like, oh, as a black woman, this person is a lawyer, a professional, someone who has all that, in the same way that it was so clear this flight attendant just totally dismissed, you know, what was happening there. We got about a minute till the break, but we'll come back to this topic, but maybe let's just start here.
Yeah, I mean, we see it across the board in so many settings. I mean, going back to some of the earlier conversations, you know, in terms of the Central Park Five that we saw come up with resurgence of Trump comments, you know, this idea of the way black individuals are stereotyped and displayed in, you know, common culture, black women generally are not portrayed in any position aside than your random Claire Huxtables who've been carefully placed in our media. You don't traditionally see us as, you know, lawyers or doctors or any of those higher positions that we think of in society to extent, not higher as if they're more important, but just professional positions. People are just not conditioned to just think, especially if you're not, you know, I know that if I'm not dressed in a suit, and even when I'm in a suit, I'm assumed at most, maybe I'm a paralegal. You know, it blows people away when it's like, oh my God, you don't look like a lawyer. And it's just like, I don't know what a lawyer is supposed to look like.
I know. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come right back to this here on By Any Means Necessary. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation about some of the legal intersections between race, sex, and class. And later in the show, we will check in about California's efforts to legalize marijuana on this election day. But we are now continuing our conversation with the Noah Changa, attorney and host of The Way with the Noah, friend of the show, of course, and by Jessica Mason Piclo, vice president, law and the courts with Rewire.news, also great friends of our show. So we've got all our friends in the house with a lot of knowledge. And Noah, we left off right before the break, just talking about this issue of in relationship to this black female doctor who is totally dismissed by this flight attendant and the expectations of black women and the lack of expectation of who they will be and what they do. And to some degree, I think so trivialized by the woman, the flight attendant, when she's trying to cover it up by offering her the Sky Miles is even still like, well, she's going to be placated with this little gift as if I didn't just like insult her core being.
Right. And I think what people often, you know, and I could understand, like, you know, I've seen some responses like, well, it was a mistake, or, you know, she wasn't, the flight attendant. People make mistakes. But the problem is when you look at these types of errors and issues and levels of microaggressions, right, they happen at so many different points of our everyday lives over so many years of living, existing, and being, at some point we have to be able to stop and point it out and call it out where it is and make changes for the better. And that is something I don't even know what you could have done to address that. The sister involved handled herself amicably, because I can only imagine, and I don't have to imagine, I've experienced having, you know, my knowledge, my credentials, like I have find, especially I find it more so when I deal with circles of white men, that I would have to basically list every credential I have, list every job I've had to back up a point that someone else can just make with no knowledge, particularly as a lawyer, right? There are so many armchair lawyers out there in the world, particularly on social media. People always want to argue, so like, you're not even accurately describing the law. You, someone without a law degree, but you're a white male, you can talk about this and no one will question you. But me as a black woman, even though I do actually have a law degree, I do actually know what I'm talking about. I've actually researched a particular issue, but I have to go through this whole litany. And it's just this conditioning, as if, you know, in terms of people of color, that somehow they're just not as good. But that's a historical issue that has been ingrained within the fabric that is American society as a whole. And we do, as Jessica talked about earlier, have to call things out. And it takes not just black people talking about race and microaggressions, as she very astutely pointed out earlier, it takes white people talking about this stuff and talking to each other about how to change that behavior. And I definitely appreciate when people talk about and advocate for that frame of thinking, because we're not going to be in those inner circles, in those private moments when people pass around jokes or tell stories or whatever, you know, it will take other people who are sharing those private moments to help debunk those stereotypes as well.
Well, I think that's a huge issue. I mean, that's one of the things we've been talking about all week on the show is like, and we will come back around to this issue for sure. I want to switch gears here, but the whole issue of like all these men being like, oh, no one ever said that around me. I never heard anything like that. And it's just like the unbelievable. Yeah, it's, I mean, come on, like Jake Tapper was the worst. Like, I was in a fraternity. I never heard anything like dog, please. Unless you're in a fraternity at like Bob Jones University or something like that. I don't even know. But be that as it may, I wanted to slightly switch gears here, Jessica. And now I'm going to be the one doing this. I'm doing my Matlock impression. I'm not a lawyer. But one of the things that was interesting to me, though, about the Bader Ginsburg comments, outside of all the things that we've talked about, was also, to me, kind of the way it dealt with the First Amendment. I mean, this is my view, is that the whole kind of point of the First Amendment is that oftentimes it's sort of the most provocative forms of speech that shake things up, the creative tension, get things moving, but, you know, can often be maybe offensive to people, upset people, which is sort of exactly why you would want to have a legal protection around it. It's not like we're all sitting around drinking tea. And that in some ways, it just seems strange to me that someone who is like on the highest court in the land and is promoting a book, like this would be a great opportunity to sort of point that out, that like we don't have quote unquote free speech that, you know, to protect people from doing something annoying, but in fact, it's like the things that might annoy us the most that are going to get us thinking. I don't know, but that, again, that's my Matlock impression. Maybe I don't even understand what I'm talking about.
Oh, no, that was a pretty great Matlock impression, and I think you hit a really important point that Ginsburg, her comments, again, just really mangled, which is, you know, we can hold two opposing ideas, hopefully, in our minds at the same time, right? We can hold the idea that it is really inherently the most critical thing to do in our democracy to preserve and protect government intrusion into speech spaces, into places we speak, into the ways in which we express ourselves, particularly with regards to political speech, but that when we are having these conversations, that we bring a critical analysis and structure to that, because, again, having this blanket, you know, what I refer to as First Amendment purity, doesn't really do anything in advancing the First Amendment writ large. It reinforces all of the power structures that are already at play. And I think that's what Ginsburg's comments point out or illustrate really perfectly. I mean, she would be the first to say, look, I'm not saying that this is speech that, you know, shouldn't be allowed to happen. Right. That's not what she said. She says, I don't want to criminalize it. I just don't think it has any value. Right. It's stupid. It's arrogant. And, you know, I make the argument that the idea that a personal, you know, value in terms of message and speech and the legal ramifications aren't that easy to disentangle. And so if we are going to have this conversation about the protest, which I think we should, and the conversation about where we are with regards to and where we're not with regards to race in this country, that we need to be on all cylinders having that conversation and not just, you know, tossing things around in a flip manner like Justice Ginsburg did.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I appreciate your confirmation of my Matlock impression there somewhere. Andy Griffiths feeling fantastic. I mean, it's a brief aside, but I have to say, when I was watching the O.J. Simpson thing on FX, and there's the moment where, what's his name, the Alan Dershowitz character, like, faxes him the thing where it's, like, going to win the case or whatever, I felt like I could do that. I mean, I don't have a law degree. I could not be a lawyer, but I do feel like I could be, like, a great, like, fourth chair outside of the room, just, like, coming up with crazy stuff and, like, I don't know, paging you 911 to check the facts. But, you know, another issue that I thought was so relevant to this, speaking of Supreme Court and the Supreme Court decisions and the Kaepernick protest, that I just don't think gets brought up enough, but I feel like we need more of a conversation around, is this issue of Graham v. Connor, the main Supreme Court decision that is sort of governing what is right about, or, you know, like, what is right or wrong about these police murders. And to some degree, like, you know, we talk so much about cameras and what was on camera, how could they not see this, blah, 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 blah. But it's not about, like, what feels wrong. It's about, like, what legally is allowed. And we're not really talking about the role of legislators in trying to pass laws that could even deal with this. Or from my point of view, from prosecutors who are taking on these cops and then losing, and then they're just like, oh, whatever, instead of appealing and being like, no, this is an absurd standard. So, I mean, as someone who works in the legal field, I mean, do we need to pay more attention to this, or is it more of a canard?
I think that the challenge in terms of, and I know Sean King has been talking a lot about this, and he's written about how he really thinks we need to have a similar strategy to the, you know, last wave of the civil rights movement, but having a Supreme Court focus about getting, you know, a really strong test case in front of the Supreme Court. I think part of the problem with focusing on changing the legal standard for police officers, I think that's a long uphill battle that will take a lot and take, honestly, a completely different makeup of the court that we're probably not going to see for several life cycles, honestly, in my opinion. But I do think that there is a lot that can be done that is being overlooked with this focus on, you know, looking at the legal standard itself. I mean, there are administrative practices and procedures that can be employed on local levels. We're talking so much of this, and it is a nationwide problem. And I'm not saying that a nationwide strategy is a bad thing. I think you absolutely need that top level federal approach happening. But at the same time, there are things that can be done with organizing on the local level in terms of, I think it was Minneapolis that just changed its use of force policy. I believe Olympia, Washington, there are groups in Olympia, Washington working together to change what they have. One of the leaders I talked to said to me was, one of the most egregious use of force policies in the country. I think that there are things that can be done because, you know, police officers, and even though this was not necessarily enforced with the Staten Island prosecutor Eric Garner's case, there is a chokehold, you know, in New York City Police Department does actually have a chokehold a policy that came into place after the murder of Luis Baez, which I think ended up being prosecuted in federal court after the state level prosecutor did not pursue it. But so there are things that can be done. You can also look at international human rights law. You know, the UN has written several reports and discuss the standards of what's happening here with police and violence that disproportionately affects, you know, Black and Latino people. Like, so there's so much else that can also be worked on. I think that having a legal strategy in terms of changing the standard itself and the way people are able to judge police reasonableness, right? I think that is a good thing to do, but I don't think that should be the end all be all. And we definitely have to look at all the tools in our toolbox. But what you hit on in terms of prosecutors and prosecutors prosecuting these cases, I think that's absolutely right. And another thing would also be having an electoral strategy in terms of local politics, and actually for those prosecutors who are elected, actually having people vet and promote and support candidates that actually have a true justice apparatus or mindset than just, you know, these are, you know, my friends, so I'm not going to go after them type of mentality, which we see in so many cases. These are just good guys just trying to do their job. You know, what we saw in Chicago with Laquan McDonald's murder and the subsequent cover-up with Anita Alvarez and others was a microcosm of what happens, unfortunately, in many places across the country. And a local strategy can definitely address that.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, and Anita Alvarez, I mean, a criminal. I mean, I'm sorry, but and you look at the Rekia Boyd case where even the judge was like, well, obviously this guy is innocent of this, but if you would have charged him with first degree murder, I would have convicted him. It's unbelievable. But, you know, it just makes me wonder, Jessica, too, in terms of our broader conversation about how we situate the Supreme Court. I mean, you know, obviously all powerful positions are important. Supreme Court, president, you know, Congress to some degree, local judge. I mean, anything with power is important. So, I mean, obviously it's relevant to raise it in the context of everything that, like, yes, who appoints it. But I honestly feel that the way it's put in our discourse, like the Supreme Court is going to determine the next 30 years of everything that happens, if that doesn't kind of short circuit to some degree the political agency of individuals. I mean, you look at, say, Brown v. Board. I don't know if there's anyone who is there on that Warren court who you would have thought when they were appointed was like, definitely about to make some groundbreaking decision on civil rights. Three of them, in fact, I believe, voted for Korematsu versus United States that allowed internment of Japanese Americans. So, you know, to some degree, the courts are also reflecting the things that are happening in our society, not just sort of approaching them from a static legal perspective, but justices are also looking at sort of what's happening, what's going on, and making decisions based off of that. So I don't know. It just sort of seems like we put too much on the Supreme Court as a political issue. But I don't know how that strikes you.
Well, I think I both agree and disagree. I mean, I think that the point about the Supreme Court and the, you know, that sort of the just grandness of it and the idea that it has as much reach as it does is both true in terms of setting large policy, but also not true in terms of the way most of us experience our day-to-day lives, and particularly the way most of us experience and engage in electoral politics and in our sort of political and cultural reality. So I love this conversation about bringing all of this activism to the local level because I think it's so important. And conservatives have done a really good job of at this for decades, right? I mean, they've stacked school boards. They've been on the local elections tip for a while now. In terms of how we were to do that with the courts, I mean, this is, you know, we've got a pipeline issue. And this, again, goes to my point of, you know, why in these progressive spaces, race really has to be a critical and centered part of our analysis because, you know, the people who are appointing justices are picking from already small pools to begin with. And as you whittle that down in terms of who are the applicants in top schools and how are they getting in and where are they coming from and all of that, that is all steeped in structural inequality. And progressives do our cause no favor to look past that in any of the circumstances.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, it's a very good point. I know you're out there in Colorado where some of the GOP conservative localism has hit the hardest on so many different levels, which, I think is certainly relevant. And you know, I know I wonder, too, you know, looking at so much of the way we frame issues, which I think is similar to what we're talking about here in terms of how we look at the role of the Supreme Court, I often find that one of the biggest problems that we have is that the way we talk about it, it's like, well, you know, there's women's issues, there's black issues, as if people like wake up in the morning and it's like, well, 9 a.m. to 10 a.m., I'm going to deal with not having a job, 10 to 11, I'm going to deal with workplace discrimination, 3 to 4, got to worry about not getting killed by the cops. I mean, it may break out that you're dealing with those things at that time, but it's like the lived experience of people. It's like all these things are kind of in there together. It's like the problems of your life. But then the way we separate it out, it's like, well, women are going to do X because Donald Trump said Y about women or Hillary Clinton said Z about women. You know what I'm saying? Like this sort of like strange false equivalency that doesn't recognize so heavily a little bit of what we've been talking about, I think, in the show here today, that the way things affect you, there's so many different quote unquote intersections that like no one approaches politics the way the media presents it back to them 9 times out of 10.
Oh, absolutely. But I also think that's more of the way that the current system, the current duopoly we have maintains power and control in the way it's been able to is because we do get reduced down into these particular, you know, target groups and that only have these lists of issues and nothing else matters allegedly. So as long as you hit if you're a Democrat, as long as you hit a few of these policy points, you know, you'll get women, you hit these other ones, you'll get Latinos, you'll get blacks, you know, you'll get the LGBT community without really digging deep and looking, like you said, at those cross sections. But this is another reason why I like seeing a lot of the cross-pollinization, so to speak, between so many different movements and groups across the country who, you know, may have been, you know, once upon a time we may have seen like seen groups that are strictly just this is the one issue, but we have so many more groups that even if my one issue is like you know, criminal justice reform or dealing with police brutality, we're now having conversations and we're working. You know, you see Black Lives Matter activists also talking about issues with immigration and detention and other, and, you know, and other stuff and vice versa. And we're seeing a lot of, you see, you know, cross-pollination with like the BDS movement, for example. Like, so I like seeing that. And I think that's starting to help challenge that we're not going to just be reduced to these blocks. We've seen it a lot in this election cycle already that people, while yes, we have this big, bad monster, Donald Trump, that has to be defeated, you know, at the same time, people are stopping and saying, like, no more. Like, we're not going to be put in just these little boxes.
Right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for the time being, but we are going to come back with more after this break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. Thanks to our guests in the past two segments. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about an ongoing effort to end the prohibition of marijuana in the state of California. And we are very happy to be joined by Jason Kinney, who's from the Yes on 64 campaign. It's Proposition 64 for folks who don't know that would end this prohibition in California. So, Mr. Kinney, thank you so much for joining the show.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
And so the first thing I wanted to start with, since there's often a lot of mischaracterization of what's proposed in these legalization referenda, what exactly is Prop 64 proposing to do?
Well, Prop 64 will fundamentally end the criminalization of marijuana in California. It extends the right, which most Californians support, that Californians should be able to use a certain amount, a minimal amount of marijuana, and cultivate a minimal marijuana in the privacy of their own home, away from children, under lock and key. Prop 64 does that and builds on a regulatory structure that California already has for medical marijuana, which was signed into law last year by Governor Jerry Brown. It takes the revenue for adult-use marijuana and puts it into critical programs such as youth programs, job training programs, local law enforcement programs. But fundamentally, and perhaps the biggest benefit of all, is that it will send a message, since California is, of course, the largest state, the largest grower of marijuana in the United States, and the largest consumer block for marijuana. It'll send a message to all across the country, including our federal government, that times need to change, that it makes no sense to continue to criminalize a substance that the President of the United States says is less harmful and less addictive than alcohol. This is the arc of justice has been bending in this direction for a very long time, and we think California is going to be the final domino to fall.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very good point. And, you know, I've argued this for some years that California is key. I mean, if you all are able to prevail in the fall, that'd be every West Coast state plus Colorado and D.C., which seems to me to be sort of the proof of concept, because I find sort of generally with this issue of ending prohibition, there's just so many rumors about what is going to happen, what isn't going to happen. And now once you sort of get California in the fold, it'll be a big message, because then we'll be able to say, like, very concretely, you know, here's, I don't know, collectively 70, 80 million people who are living in states with legal marijuana, and none of these sort of boogeyman stories came true. But I don't know what you think about that.
No, I couldn't agree more. I mean, the opponents, and look, this campaign is dealing with the same sort of tired, scare tactic, fear-mongering opposition about the impacts of marijuana that we've seen all across the country, and frankly, that has suppressed good, accurate information about this issue for four decades. But, you know, we now have proof for states like Colorado and Washington and Oregon. The opponents would have you believe it's Mad Max beyond Thunderdome in those states, while anyone who's paying any attention whatsoever knows those states are thriving, the systems are succeeding, teen use of marijuana has actually gone down, public safety is up, and fundamentally, they're working. Now, they've had some hiccups and they've had some problems, things that California has learned from. Prop 64 is... And our, you know, we wrote it to be the gold standard for marijuana policy that can be used as a model across the nation. And we learned a lot of the lessons of the other legalized states. But fundamentally, you're right. I think if the Western states are all legal, they're coordinating, they're working together. And by the way, there's a meaningful public safety component to that in terms of export-import. you know, our states will be able to better enforce their borders. The one Department of Justice, and by border I mean in terms of marijuana, I'm not talking about immigration,
right.
I don't want to sound like Donald Trump here, but no, the fundamental and the way this is, the reason this is so important is because the Obama administration has made it very clear that states have the right to set their own and create their own marijuana destinies as long as they do it within their own borders. And in a state like California, which is the largest exporter of all the states within the country, that will continue to be an issue. And the fact that we were going to be able to coordinate with our western border states, the states that border California, is going to be a net positive. It's going to allow us to work together in a meaningful way. And the most important part of Prop 64, just like Amendment 64 in Colorado and others, is that it's going to allow us to rededicate our law enforcement and public safety resources on the things that matter. We need to enforce the rules around a legal, regulated, safe marijuana system, but we can also dedicate money to things that, you know, drug driving, violent crimes, things that are much more important, and things that, frankly, the people of California have long been saying we need to spend more time paying attention to.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I mean, and it's certainly, you look at just the disparities in the number of people who are arrested for possession as opposed to sale or production. I mean, it's huge amounts of money being, you know, used to, like, prosecute or not prosecute people who are with dime bags. Well, you know, one of the things that has been interesting, it's sort of the key, one of the tips of the spears in the opposition to this that I certainly find interesting in some states has been the alcohol industry. Have you seen that in California, that some of these beer, wine, and liquor companies have also been jumping in on the other side?
Yeah, we have not seen that here in California. And part of it is, there's a lot of crossover between our world-renowned wine country and our increasingly world-renowned Emerald Triangle marijuana territory. And there are a lot of folks, those counties are very close to each other. The most high-profile political supporter of Prop 64 is a guy named Gavin Newsom, who's not only the lieutenant governor of California, but owns four wineries in Napa and has worked very closely with our grape growers and our agriculture. This is the first marijuana measure that's been on the ballot in California that has not been opposed by the agricultural community, that has not been opposed by workers or the Wine Institute. And I think it's because we've worked so hard to build a coalition of support around this measure. We work very closely with local government. We work very closely with law enforcement. We work right now. You know, the political leadership of the police chiefs and state sheriffs are still opposed. They're the leading opponents of this measure. But we have, you know, the Chamber of Commerce isn't opposed for the first time ever. It's those kind of pieces. And then we have groups in support that have never been support before, like the California Medical Association, the California Nurses Association. And so, you know, so yes, you're right. Historically and in other states, the alcohol industry has been opposed, but you know, we've been blessed, knock on wood, so far in California that has not been an issue here.
Mm-hmm. Well, and perhaps good news for other states that are looking to follow in your tracks. And, you know, one of the other things I'm interested in your thoughts on is, it seems to me that one big subsidiary effect of this could be a boost to medical marijuana, because I've always felt when you look at California, sort of the big joke that everyone makes is like, oh, well, they only have medical marijuana, but it's just anyone can get a car, blah, 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 blah. And it sort of makes medical marijuana seem like this thing that's just a way people are lying to be able to recreationally use marijuana. And I wonder that the success of Prop 64 can maybe to some degree help reset that debate, not just in California, but nationwide, by kind of separating out the issues between criminal justice, public health, criminal justice, you know, quality of life, taxes, whatever, and the issue of the medicinal value of marijuana. I mean, it seems like that could also be a big boost, is ending this kind of easy punching bag sort of thing that people who are opposed to ending prohibition often use, which is like, oh, well, look at California. They got billboards and ads in the back of newspapers and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Look, I have the greatest amount, and the people in support of Prop 64 have the greatest amount of respect for the people who are on the front line of the medical marijuana movement that led to 215, that really kind of started with the, frankly, you know, AIDS relief movement in San Francisco in the early 80s. And so, you know, that's a political passion for many that we want to support and protect. But the problem with our medical system is we have, because there's no adult use alternatives, we're forcing otherwise responsible adults who are non-symptomatic, non-patients, to continue to divert into a medical system, burden our health system, burden our physician-patient relationship when we have no reason being part of that. And so, you know, there's a reason why the California Medical Association, which represents every physician in the state, supports this. They want to strengthen the medical system, and they believe the best way to strengthen the medical system is to make sure that medical marijuana is regulated like medicine, and adult use marijuana is regulated like alcohol. And those two things should not be the same thing. They are different things. Medical grade marijuana is a different issue than people who want to, you know, responsibly use marijuana for non-medical reasons. They also believe in clinical research around this issue. And again, we strengthen the medical system when we start treating medical marijuana like real medicine. And the only way to do that is to fund the clinical research necessary. Frankly, the kind of research that's been suppressed for four decades in this country. Peer-reviewed clinical trials, real research through the UC system, through our private institutions. This is California-based research. We're going to be at the cutting edge of a new, you know, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars of patented and new information around, you know, around the medical uses of marijuana. And I think people are very excited about that. Certainly our physician community is, our science community is, but it only works. You only have a real medical marijuana system if you have a compendium adult use system at the same time. Otherwise, as you point out, we're making a mockery of the medical system by forcing everybody in the state into it. And that's not the way it should be.
No, I certainly agree with that. So you mentioned that you had Gavin Newsom on board. I mean, how has been the reception overall from lawmakers out in California?
Well, we have more elected official endorsers than any marijuana measure ever in California. Now, that's not saying a lot. The last time it was on the ballot, there was almost no political support. But, you know, we have the support of the California Democratic Party, California. And we have, you know, some of those prominent state legislators. We have mayors. We have mayors-elect. We have city council members. Now, you know, this is one of those issues. It's a little like marriage equality. It's a little like health care reform. It's a little like some of these issues which, frankly, the general public has moved faster than our elected officials. And there's still some hesitancy among elected officials to fully embrace this. But, you know, again, when Prop 64 passes and every public poll that's been conducted in the last 18 months says that it's 60% or more of the state is enthusiastically in support of passes, I think that's going to change. And we've written Prop 64 in a way where we've learned the lesson of other states. We know changes will have to be made as we go. So even though the measure will pass, the legislature and regulators are still going to play a significant role in this process. And they're going to be, and the onus is going to be on them to make sure that it's working. So, you know, like, again, we've come light years over the last 6 years in terms of public support. But, you know, to the credit of the leaders who have been at the forefront of this movement for a long time, you know, they didn't get into it. You know, they're changing the polls. They're not following the polls. And now the polls are with us. And like I said, the arc of history seems to be bending in our direction. And I think that's a good thing.
I think so. And has this become an issue at all in the Senate race out there? I know that's been, you know, much more about style than substance to a large degree from what I've been reading in the California media. But I just wonder, because from a national perspective, whoever the next senator is from California, it seems like they will, to some degree, be a voice that will be looked to on this issue in the national conversation based on what's happening back home.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I'll be frank. I mean, our current incumbent United States senators are split on this issue. Dianne Feinstein has been a longtime opponent of marijuana liberalization. Barbara Boxer has been relatively supportive. She's not specifically endorsed 64, but she's generally supported legalization, to her credit. It hasn't been that big of an issue, partially because it's a Democrat-on-Democrat fight, as you probably know, between our sitting Attorney General Kamala Harris and a Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez. Kamala Harris has come out and said she thinks legalization, full legalization in California is inevitable. She did predict just last week that 64 is going to pass, that she thinks California is ready to implement 64. She cannot endorse specific ballot measures because, as Attorney General, she writes the title and summary on ballot measures. She actually writes the language that appears on the ballot, so she can't take positions on any ballot measure. As far as I can tell, Loretta Sanchez has not taken a position. She's not opposed. She's not supported. You know, so the issues come up. It hasn't been what I would call a defining issue in the race.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I wonder, you know, what you think about the electorate and certainly the polls showing that you guys are doing well. I mean, do you expect that, or maybe not expect that, maybe is that due to the sort of presidential election thing? I mean, I remember when Prop 19 was out there, that was kind of kind of the big knock is like, well, why do this in a non-presidential year, more conservative electorate, and so on and so forth. I mean, and given the intense interest in this race, do you find that maybe perhaps will be, you know, maybe the kicker is just that more individuals in general, and certainly more that are probably favorable to progressive ideas, will be at the polls?
Yeah, look, more turnout is good for Prop 64. More turnout is good overall. You know, more turnout's good for democracy, right? But you know, I think the more people that turn out, the better Prop 64 will do. I would point out that this is one of those issues that, you know, in a year of unprecedented conflict between presidential candidates, this is one of those few issues where they seem to agree. I certainly Secretary Clinton's been more outspoken and more involved in her position on marijuana, but even Donald Trump, I mean, they both have said they will respect the Obama administration's position and allow states to make their own determination about marijuana policy within their own borders. So this happens to be one of the few areas where they both agree. Would point out that Bernie Sanders endorsed Prop 64. Gary Johnson has endorsed Prop 64. And there's a broad federal coalition. You know, we have Republican and Democratic congressmen who are supporting Prop 64. So, you know, like I said, it remains illegal at the federal level, but this is the first election I've been part of where, you know, the federal officials on the ballot seem to be agree on the ability of the states to make their own decisions. And that's a big deal.
No, absolutely. Well, I know that voters in Washington, D.C. will be happy to hear that the congressional delegation in California is jumping on, given that they have so much control over the things that happen to us here. And then some folks from Maryland have been meddling. But nevertheless, I think very interesting piece. And it's a good point, too, because it flew under the radar. But like a couple years back, even Sarah Palin was saying she thought there should be at least some form of decriminalization for people under the circumstances.
It's a fundamentally libertarian position. And I happen to be a Democrat, but, you know, I long for the day where the Republican Party kind of gets back to their libertarian roots. And by the way, the polling shows broad support among Republicans. Now, like a lot of issues, it's linked to age. But self-identified Republicans who are under the age of 35 are supporting Prop 64 in wide numbers. And so, you know, we're conceding no demographic group. You know, we have made a very strong case to Republican clubs all across the state that, you know, this is a fundamental libertarian issue. There's just no reason to decriminalize, you know, the private use of marijuana, which is less harmful, less addictive than alcohol.
And with that, we're out of time for today's show. That's By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.